5th of September. And this is number 8 now in the continuing series on the seven angels. I'd like to note with you a statement now from Patriarchs and Prophets, which confirms some of the points we made earlier in this series. Page 68 in the book Patriarchs and Prophets. But the plan of redemption had a yet broader and deeper purpose than the salvation of man. It was not for this alone that Christ came to the earth. It was not merely that the inhabitants of this little world might regard the law of God as it should be regarded, but it was to vindicate the character of God before the universe. Now that statement, read so far, confirms the fact that the issues in the great controversy are much wider than merely the salvation of man. And notice that's why I use the word merely. And of course, mere means something of relative insignificance in respect to the larger perspective of the full scope and problem of the work to be undertaken. So listen again. The plan of redemption had a yet broader and deeper purpose than the salvation of man. It was not for this alone that Christ came to the earth. It was not merely that the inhabitants of this little world might regard the law of God as it should be regarded, but it was to vindicate the sacrifice of God, the character of God, before the universe. To this result of his great sacrifice, its influence upon the intelligences of other worlds as well as upon man, the Savior looked forward when just before his crucifixion he said, "Now is the judgment of this world. Now shall the prince of this world be cast out. And I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men unto me." The act of Christ in dying for the salvation of man would not only make heaven accessible to men, but before all the universe, it would justify God and his Son in their dealing with the rebellion of Satan. It would establish the perpetuity of the law of God and would reveal the nature and the results of sin. That's a very fine statement, isn't it? Turn to another one now in the book Desire of Ages this time, which brings forth the same thought in these words. Coming up. Page 37. Desire of Ages, page 37. Now, as I read this statement, you must remember the text we quoted in the last session where God said, "I am the Lord, I change not, therefore you sons of Jacob are not destroyed." With intense interest, the unfallen worlds had watched to see Jehovah arise and sweep away the inhabitants of this earth. In other words, what did the unfallen worlds expect to see God do? That's right. They expected that. Now, why did they expect that?
Well, that had never been revealed before.
Yes, never been revealed before God, how God would cope with a situation like this. It was something new. How would God cope with it? And Satan had spread through the universe the argument that this was the only way such a problem could be dealt with. That God must do it that way. But now, let's see the consequences which would have followed if God had done that. And if God should do this, Satan was ready to carry out his plan for securing to himself the allegiance of heavenly beings. He had declared that the principles of God's government would make forgiveness impossible. Had the world been destroyed, he would have claimed that his accusations were proved true. He was ready to cast blame upon God and to spread his rebellion to the worlds above. But instead of destroying the world, God sent his Son to save it. Though corruption and defiance might be seen in every part of the Arian province, a way for his recovery was provided. At the very crisis, when Satan seemed about to triumph, the Son of God came with the embassage of divine love. A divine grace. Through every age, through every hour, the love of God had been exercised toward the fallen race. Notwithstanding the perversity of men, the signals of mercy had been continually exhibited. And when the fullness of the time had come, the deity was glorified by pouring upon the world a flood of healing grace that was never to be obstructed or withdrawn till the plan of salvation should be fulfilled.
Brother Wright, John 12:32 says, I will draw all men unto me, but men is a sublime word, so really he could draw the whole universe to him.
That's correct. Absolutely. I will draw all unto me. Now, it's this larger perspective that I'm anxious that you folk will catch today, because, you know, if we go back to the early astronomers, the very earliest astronomers, they thought that this world was the center of the entire universe. Isn't that right? They thought that. And that was, of course, a very self-centered view. It made this world look as if it was the most important in all the world. But modern gospel preaching also tends toward developing self-centeredness in people. The modern gospel makes the individual the whole focus of the entire work of the plan of salvation. Whereas this view makes us realize that we are not to be saved just for the sake of being saved, but that we are to be participant with God in the work of self-sacrifice, in the work of giving ourselves in a total way for the redemption of others. And that this world becomes the stage or theater on which and in which the principles of the great controversy are worked out and exhibited so that all the universe can look on and behold the outworking of God's principles and the outworking of Satan's principles. Now, the great crisis point came in the Garden of Gethsemane. Let's turn across there now and read this statement, which tells how that when Christ was agonizing there in the garden, and the great crisis point had come, that the rest of the universe looked on to see what was going to happen. Page 693 in the book Desire of Ages. The world's unfallen, and the heavenly angels had watched with intense interest as the conflict drew to its close. Satan and his confederacy of evil, the legions of apostasy, watched intently this great crisis in the work of redemption. The powers of good and evil waited to see what answer would come to Christ's thrice-repeated prayer. Angels had longed to bring relief to the divine sufferer, but this must not be. No way of escape was found for the Son of God. In this awful crisis, note that word crisis, when everything was at stake. Now, it doesn't say everything in this world. It doesn't say everything for man. It says everything was at stake. And how wide-reaching does that word everything encompass?
The universe.
Right, everything in the universe. In this awful crisis, when everything was at stake, when the mysterious cup trembled in the hand of the sufferer, the heavens opened, a light shone forth amid the stormy darkness of the crisis hour, and the mighty angel who stands in God's presence, occupying the position from which Satan fell, came to the side of Christ. The angel came not to take the cup from Christ's hand, but to strengthen him to drink it, with the assurance of the Father's love. He came to give power to the divine human suppliants. He pointed him to the open heavens, telling him of the souls that would be saved as a result of his sufferings. He assured him that his Father is greater and more powerful than Satan, that his death would result in the utter discomfiture of Satan, and that the kingdom of this world would be given to the saints of the Most High. He told him that he would see of the travail of his soul and be satisfied, for he would see a multitude of the human race saved, eternally saved. We turn back now to Revelation 12. We saw in our last study period that verses 7 to 9 applied back when Satan was cast out of heaven, and verses 10 and 11 applied to the victory gained by Jesus Christ upon the cross. We read from Desire of Ages and recognized together that at the cross, the purpose of the great controversy was largely fulfilled so far as the angels were concerned, although in Desire of Ages, page 761, we were told that the angels even had more yet to learn before they would be entirely and completely educated in regard to the character of God and the character of Satan. The angels did not even then understand all that was involved in the great controversy. The principles at stake were to be more fully revealed. Now, very naturally, however, when Satan recognized that he no longer had any access to or influence upon the angelic minds, then would he waste any more time on that which he knew was a lost cause to him? Would he? Of course not. Now, before the cross, had his evil ministry toward the angels occupied a great deal of time and energy on his part, very obviously, because there's a lot of angels who've not fallen. Now, that time and energy devoted to angels before the cross, what does Satan do with that this side of the cross?
Concentration on us.
Absolutely. So we today receive all the attention of Satan which he gave to mankind before the cross, plus all the attention Satan gave to the angels before the cross. So we today have at least a double amount of attention from his satanic majesty. Now, I don't doubt to emphasize this point further. Inasmuch as Satan recognized that he must work against the angels more than against men, that he gave the angels the majority of his time and attention before the cross, and now, of course, he concentrates all that upon man. Therefore, verse 12 says, "Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you that dwell in them." Now, why is it that the angels are called upon to rejoice once the death of Christ upon the cross of Calvary had achieved the purpose of the great controversy for them? It was because they were now set free, their questions were cleared up, the doubts and worries were gone, their minds enjoyed perfect freedom, and they no longer had to be concerned about Satan's sophistries and Satan's lies. "Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you that dwell in them." But their happy day is a blacker day for the human race, and so the scripture says, "Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea." Why? Because for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time. So the period of woe is upon man ever since the time when the angels were delivered from the sophistries of Satan back there at the cross. But even today, the angels of God must keep their eyes continually upon the cross, because without the daily vision of the cross, they are not secure. In the Bible Commentary, volume 5, page 11, yes, 1132 is the page. It there says, "The death of Christ upon the cross made sure the destruction of him who has the power of death, who was the originator of sin. When Satan is destroyed, there will be none to tempt to evil. The atonement will never need to be repeated, and there will be no danger of another rebellion in the universe of God. That which alone can effectually restrain from sin in this world of darkness will prevent sin in heaven." The significance of the death of Christ will be seen by saints and angels. Fallen men could not have a home in the paradise of God without the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Shall we not then exalt the cross of Christ? Now listen. The angels ascribe honor and glory to Christ, for even they are not secure except by looking to the sufferings of the Son of God. It is through the efficacy of the cross that the angels of heaven are guarded from apostasy. Isn't that something? It is through the, without the cross, they would be no more secure against evil than were the angels before the fall of Satan. Angelic perfection failed in heaven. Human perfection failed in Eden, the paradise of bliss. All who wished for security in earth or heaven must look to the Son of God. So today, at this very moment, every time an argument or question comes up from Satan, as I hear it and see it upon this earth, the angels must look at the witness or the revelation of God's character as given at the cross of Calvary. If they didn't do that, then what would they do even at this present time? They'd fall. They would fall. And through all of the coming eternity, what will be that which will forever safeguard heaven against a repeating of this sin problem? The cross, right? But then what is the cross? Come back to Satan's objective and his method and the result, and God's objective, method and result. What is the cross of Calvary?
The ultimate self-sacrifice of
love. Right, it is that. But what else is it? The revelation of God's character. The supreme revelation of God's character. It is that revelation of God's character which is the test of all other revelations of God's character. Is that right? And as it says in the Great Controversy, the mystery of the cross explains all other mysteries. So when we go back to the Old Testament and we read there that God said to Israel, destroy the Amalekites, men, women, children, flocks, herds, until there's nothing left, exterminate them. Carry out what we call today a genocide, which is the extermination of a race of people. And as we look at that, and from that we get certain ideas and certain conceptions of God's character, before we become confirmed in our belief of what we think that means, let's take our view of God there back to the cross and test our view at the cross. And if that view of God's character seen in the Old Testament stands the test of the revelation of God's character at the cross, if those two views are in harmony, then we know our view of God in the Old Testament is correct. But if it doesn't agree, then what? Some revision is needed, some further study, some deeper digging, some more earnest prayer before we can answer and understand the great problems raised by God's behavior in the Old Testament. Now let's bear in mind that the angels themselves, who were personally participant with God in the destruction of Korah and Abiram, in the 10 plagues of Egypt, in the death of Sennacherib's army, in the wasting of Amalek, and all those various disasters and things, the fire of Sodom and Gomorrah, the flood, the angels were personally participant with God in that work. And if the angels of God, who saw behind the scenes what we cannot see, could not understand the character of God until the cross, then what hope do we have of truly understanding God in the Old Testament except in the light that streams from Calvary? What hope do we have? None. Absolutely none. The cross is our security. The cross is the great revelation of the height and the breadth and the depth and the length of the love of God. Now, one of the Sister Wives said in volume 8 of the testimonies, everything that man needs to know or can know about God has been revealed in the life and character of his Son. Everything. It is a supreme revelation of God's character. But what else is the cross? It is also the supreme revelation of Satan's character. Isn't that so? It is both. Because there at the cross, we find the focal point or the meeting point of all the issues of good and evil. And Satan was there with everything which he had in his full fruition and development. And Christ was there with all that he had, likewise, in his full mature development. And so when the angels have a question today, where do they go? Back to the cross. When we have a question, where must we go? Back to the cross. It's the starting point and the ending point of every doubt, every question, every problem that the human mind or the angelic minds can ever conceive. And eternally, the cross is our life insurance, the guarantee that never again will sin arise in the universe anywhere. Now, we made the observation that Jesus Christ, if he'd only come to die for man, could have done that back at the gates of Eden. But he waited for something like 4,000 years. We've already read the scripture which says in Galatians 4:4, but when the fullness of the time has come, then what? God sent forth his Son. And we made some comments yesterday that fullness of time is not as a person determines a wedding date or a picnic date by as a matter of convenience. That fullness of time came when there had arrived the development of certain crucial conditions down here upon this earth. Now let's consider what those conditions were. We read from the Psalm of Ages 21 that the character of God had to be revealed in contrast to the character of Satan. We also recognize that the only place where Satan's character is revealed is in the flesh and blood bodies of human beings. Likewise, therefore, the character of God must also be revealed in the flesh and blood body of human beings, the same flesh and blood. And this gives to us, of course, another mighty argument and a further powerful confirmation of the truth that Jesus Christ came in the same flesh and blood as the children, not in the sinless flesh and blood of Adam before the fall. Of course, if we'd accepted the heresy that Christ came in sinless flesh and blood, we would never have seen the truth of the seven angels, would we? Never. Now, up in heaven, of course, we have first of all the confrontation between Christ and the rebellious Lucifer. And up there, of course, Christ did reveal the Father's character and his dealings with the prince of evil. But because Satan's character had not yet come to full mature development, it was impossible to give in heaven, before Satan was cast out, a revelation of God's character that would suffice to settle the question. Satan must come to this earth. Satan must implant in man his own character. And as the centuries and millenniums roll by, Satan must work to develop in man the full maturity of that character, while God, of course, was counterworking to frustrate the designs of Satan. And it required 4,000 years of Satan working against God to bring things to that place where the character of Satan was fully developed in fallen, sinful man. Now, the Bible tells us this. Let's turn to Daniel, the 8th chapter. Daniel, chapter 8. And here we have that extremely significant and important prophecy in regard to the little horn tower and the 2,300 days. Now, we'll be coming back to this prophecy in a few days, more or less, because we have some truly great light to share with you from this chapter that I think is very wonderful, and I hope that you folk feel the same. Now, let's come to verse 21 of Daniel chapter 8. And the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king, and that, of course, was Alexander the Great. Verse 22, now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. And those are the four kings or four generals of Alexander, Lysimachus, Cassander, Ptolemy, and Seleucus, who shared the kingdom up between them, the north, the south, the east, and the west. But now I'm concerned about verse 23, which says, and in the latter time of their kingdom, and what's the next phrase say, or clause say? When the transgressors are come to the fore. A king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. Now, who was that king? Pagan Rome. The little horn power. And the word of God says, with the advent of the Roman Empire, what about transgression? It came to the fore. As you read into verse 25, of course, you find this little horn power destroyed the Son of God. Now, I come back to this chapter entitled The Fullness of Time, from which we read a little earlier in this study period already. And here on page 36, I find these words which tell us the nature of sin at the time of the first advent. The statement says, the deception of sin had reached its height. All the agencies for depraving the souls of men had been put in operation. The Son of God, looking upon the world, beheld suffering and misery. With pity, he saw how men had become victims of satanic cruelty. He looked with compassion upon those who were being corrupted, murdered, and lost. They had chosen a ruler who chained them to his car as captives. Bewildered and deceived, they were moving on in gloomy procession toward eternal ruin, to death in which is no hope of life, toward night to which comes no morning. Satanic agencies were incorporated with men. The bodies of human beings, made for the dwelling place of God, had become the habitation of demons. The senses, the nerves, the passions, the organs of men were worked by supernatural agencies in the indulgence of the vilest lust. The very stamp of demons was impressed upon the countenances of men. Human faces reflected the expression of the legions of evil with which they were possessed. Such was the prospect upon which the world's Redeemer looked. What a spectacle for infinite purity to behold. Sin had become a science, and vice was consecrated as a part of religion. Rebellion had struck its roots deep into the hearts, and the hostility of man was most violent against heaven. It was demonstrated before the universe that, apart from God, humanity could not be uplifted. A new element of life and power must be imparted by him who made the world. Now that was the situation. Sin had reached this height. Men had become totally captivated by Satan's power, and Satan was providing the world with a complete demonstration of his character through the channel of fallen, sinful human nature. Things could not have got worse. And as we read before, so I read again, with intense interest, the unfallen worlds had watched to see Jehovah arise and sweep away the inhabitants of the earth. In other words, they said, this is too much. How can the God of purity permit such a thing to go on in his kingdom? How can he endure it? And as we read before, if God had done that, Satan was ready to carry out his plan for securing to himself the allegiance of heavenly beings. But instead of doing that, instead of destroying the world, God sent his son to save it. The corruption and defiance might be seen in every part of the alien province. A way for its recovery was provided. At the very crisis, when Satan seemed about to triumph, the Son of God came with the embassage of divine grace. Now, I'd like you to note that point in particular. At the very crisis, when Satan seemed about to triumph, the Son of God came with the embassage of divine love. Now, another way of saying at the very crisis is to say when the fullness of the time had come, right? When the fullness of the time had come. And the important thing to understand is this, that Jesus Christ could not have come before he did, because he had to wait until the full revelation of Satan's character was to be given, and only then could Jesus Christ come and give the full revelation of God's character side by side with the character of Satan. In other words, Christ came at the point of greatest disadvantage, when the work was the very hardest it could possibly be, when Satan had the most power, and when he himself was reduced to the greatest possible weakness. That is when Jesus Christ came to do it, and under those circumstances he did it, made no concession to Satan's lie of the law had to be broken, and proved forever the immutability of God's law and the perfection of God's character. It was a stupendous task and a magnificent achievement. But let's be sobered by the thoughts that that same stupendous task has to again be matched by a magnificent achievement. And you and I have to do it. That's food for thought, isn't it? That's food for thought. Now, we know that as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. But let's turn now to Revelation chapter 18 for a moment and pick up their statement that parallels the words of Daniel chapter 8. And back in Daniel chapter 8, what did it say? In the latter time of their kingdom, what follows? When the transgressors are come to the full. Now, what's it say in Revelation chapter 18? Verse 5. For her sins have reached where? Unto heaven. And how much higher can they reach? That's the ultimate in rebellion, isn't it? The ultimate. It is prefigured by the action of King Belshazzar, when on the night of his destruction, he called his lords together in that tremendous feast which they had, and they took the very golden vessels of the sanctuary, and they filled them with the wine of Babylon, and held them up in defiance before God, and drank from those vessels of God. That night, the sins of Belshazzar reached where? To heaven. And in that night, what became of him? He perished. He perished because he had removed from himself every link of protection that God could ever provide him, and left the Medo-Persians to come in and take over the kingdom. Now, of course, back in those days, the entire world was not destroyed because it was only a small part whose sin reached to heaven. But when it says here in Revelation 18, verse 5, her sins have reached unto heaven, then how many of the people upon this earth are involved in that total rebellion against God?
All
right. Every single one except those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. All but the little company standing in the light. All but them. So it will be a universal rebellion, a universal confederacy of defiance against the God of heaven, a universal acquiescence to the idea that the law must be broken in order for it to be maintained, a universal upholding of the belief that self must be cared for no matter what the cost may be. Self must come first, our rights must be fought for, and unless we protect ourselves and nobody else is going to protect them. That is the spirit of Babylon, the enthronement of self above all else, under any consideration. So we find then a distinct parallel between the work of Jesus Christ and the work which God will do for the 144,000 down at the end of time. Now let's just pull this all together again now. We go back to the Old Testament and we have the Lamb which pointed forward to a sacrifice of death. And we have the first fruits, and that points forward to a living sacrifice. Now, by his death, Jesus Christ paid the penalty. So here we find the penalty is paid, and without that death, there would be no harvest. Right? No death, no harvest. But now on the other side, and this, of course, points to Jesus Christ alone. Because only Christ had the life which could pay the penalty for our sins. But the first fruits point forward to a living sacrifice, and this was not the paying of a penalty, but this involved a demonstration, the gaining of a victory. And without the gaining of that victory, Satan would be the overcomer in the battle, in the great controversy, and if he overcame, he could rightfully claim all the bodies and lives of those who were locked up in his prison house of death, and there'd be no deliverance for anybody. Right? So once again, there would be no harvest without that demonstration. Now, but this points forward, first of all, to the work of Jesus Christ, and secondly, to the work of Christ through the 144,000. I want now to embark on a brief study of the order of last day events, always a very interesting subject to us, to share with you the picture of that moment of time when the purpose of the great controversy will have been achieved so far as the wicked are concerned. Now, we'll just start this because we only have about 10 minutes left, and then we'll pick it up again in our next session, but at least we'll start it. Now, we're all familiar. I'll just put down the main headlines with which we are familiar to get a framework going here. We're all familiar with the fact that the next great development in the world today is the unity of churches. That's the very next event to take place, the unity of churches. And down in Australia, there has been a very big union take place in the last few months. It's called the Uniting Church of Christ. It involves, I've just forgotten now, but I think it involves Methodists and Congregationalists, doesn't it? Remember? I mean, it's Methodist and Congregation, it doesn't matter very much anyway, but there's two extremely large Presbyterian, three of the biggest church organisations in Australia outside the Catholic Church, Congregationalists, Methodists and Presbyterians. The Church of England is also very large, otherwise called over here the Episcopalian, and we call it the Anglican Church, but it's not involved at the moment in this unity. Now there are dissenters who don't go along with this programme, there always will be, I suppose, until the end, and the dissenters call themselves the Continuing Church of Christ. They just call themselves the Uniting Church of Christ. Now, at the same time as the unity of churches is going on, there is something happening in the true Church of God. And as I read the Word of God, that which is to happen within the Church of God is the message of the third angel swells toward the loud cry. Now, let me ask you something. What is the witness of your own senses as you've heard the message of the fourth angel, which is the loud cry of the third angel? Aren't we seeing the message of the third angel swelling and swelling and swelling every year we get together? Isn't it? It's swelling. You think of the light we saw last year, we didn't see the year before. And the year before, we didn't see the year before that. And look at this, what I think is magnificent truth that God is giving to us this year. The message is swelling. It isn't swelling like this, that is, with a steady increase. It's swelling like this, with a rapidly increasing swelling. So every year the light gets much bigger. In other words, the advanced steps each year are much greater than the year before. Isn't that how you feel? Good. So then, while the unity of churches is going on, the third angel is swelling toward the loud cry, as we see in this diagram. Now, the reason as to why the churches are uniting is that their unity will give them power. You know the old story, divided we fall, united we stand, and unity there is strength. And so they unite with one objective, and that is to get the strength that they might go before the Congress of the United States of America and other governments around the world and bring in the Sunday law. And when the Sunday law is passed, then, as you know perfectly well, that might give you all the references again, the image of the beast is formed. Now, when the image of the beast is formed, the time has come for the loud cry to begin. And maybe I'll just read some quick references now from the Great Controversy in this chapter entitled The Final Warning. On page 605 it says, "Heretofore, those who presented the truth of the third angel's message have often been regarded as mere alarmists. Their predictions of religious intolerance would gain control in the United States, that church and state would unite to persecute those who keep the commandments of God, have been pronounced groundless and absurd. It has been confidently declared that this land could never become other than what it has been, the defender of religious freedom. But as the question of enforcing Sunday observance is widely agitated, the event so long doubted and disbelieved has seemed to be approaching, and the third message will produce an effect which it could not have had before." And of course, that is still slightly in the future, because we must see the unity of churches before we see this intensive Sunday agitation. But it's coming, and coming very, very soon. The next paragraph speaks about the way in which the reformers have always tried to bring in their message very gently and persuasively, but the power of God comes upon them and they speak the truth of God irrespective of consequences. The last sentence in the paragraph reads, "The word which the Lord gave them they uttered, fearless of consequences, and the people were compelled to hear the warning. Thus the message of the third angel will be proclaimed. As the time comes for it to be given with greatest power, the Lord will work through humble instruments, leading the minds of those who consecrate themselves to his service. The labors will be qualified rather by the unction of his Spirit than by the training of literary institutions. Men of faith and prayer will be constrained to go forth with holy zeal, declaring the word which God gives them. The sins of Babylon will be laid open. The fearful results of enforcing the observance of the church by civil authority, the inroads of spiritualism, the stealthy but rapid progress of the papal power, all will be unmasked. By these solemn warnings, the people will be stirred. Thousands upon thousands will listen, have never heard words like these. In amazement, they hear the testimony that Babylon is the church, fallen because of her errors and sins, because of a rejection of the truth sent to her from heaven." And that's going to be some impact. So these events begin to happen now. The latter rain falls upon consecrated, prayerful, faithful people, and they're constrained to go forth, and the sins of Babylon are laid open, and the people listen with amazement in every direction. But now the people show a very natural reaction. They go to their ministers or their former teachers with the eager inquiry, "Are these things so?" The ministers present fables, prophesy smooth things to soothe their fears and quiet the awakened conscience. So at first, the only reaction on the part of the ministry is kind of a
Well, a low-key reaction. They in their mind, they just dismiss this as a local excitement, and it's just going to pass. I mean, after all, they've always been able to persuade their people. They've had complete power over them, and they just simply say, well, look, don't worry about this. It's just a little fire in the coin. It'll be out in a few days, and it's all nonsense anyway. Just forget about it, you know. It's no troubles. But the people are not going to forget about it. And it says, but since many refuse to be satisfied with the mere authority of men and demand they plain, thus saith the Lord, the popular ministry, like the Pharisees of old, filled with anger as their authority is questioned, will denounce the message as of Satan and stir up the sin-loving multitude to revile and persecute those who proclaim it. And so when the ministry finds that this is not just a fire in the corner, that the people have now the power of independent thinking and questioning, then they stir up persecution to stop this thing. But that persecution so far is nothing more than simply cold shouldering and a little bit of abuse and maybe a little bit of violence, but nothing more than simply individual attacks upon us when that time comes. It doesn't yet involve the law of the land. That is to follow as the message extends to new fields and the minds of the people are really stirred up about this thing. Now, I have to leave it there, unfortunately, because time has run out on us again. The tapes will be clicking off in a moment. When we come back this afternoon, we'll pursue this order of last day events right through, and our main interest will be to come to that point when we have the testimony telling how the entire world becomes changed in their mind in regard to their attitude to the law of God, and for the first time they see God's law as it really is. When that point of time comes, the purpose of the great controversy will have been achieved, and the work will end.